Hello, and welcome to our podcast mini-series where we speak with leading women across the energy and industrial sectors. My name is Stephanie Fishman, a senior associate here at Hogan Lovells, working with clients in the nuclear energy space and your host for this episode. Today, I am thrilled to be joined by Jackie Siebens, friend and director of public affairs for Helion Energy, a fusion company enabling a future with unlimited clean electricity. Welcome, Jackie, and thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, so let's start by diving into your background a bit. I know you started out in the nuclear non-proliferation space and are now working at the front lines of fusion development. Can you share a bit about your journey? What inspired you to pursue a career in energy?
Sure. Yeah, so I've had an interesting sort of meandering path that led from that background in security and nonproliferation to advocating for keeping our existing nuclear plants online and building new nuclear plants to now, sort of diving into the fusion space. So I'll give sort of an overview of how all that transpired. My undergraduate degree was actually in history at East Carolina University in North Carolina. And I really sort of had envisioned myself taking the route of academia and becoming a professor. I had this vision of myself as this female Indiana Jones, sort of traversing the world, doing really cool things in history. And when I graduated, I had the opportunity to work in the dean's office of my college for a year before I figured out what next steps were for me. And what I learned from that experience, I got closer to my former history professors, and they got kind of real with me about what their jobs were actually like. And so the most exciting stuff that I was working on, or learning, I guess, rather, in the classroom is not the stuff they were working on day to day. They were working on journal articles that maybe 20 people in the entire world would care about, and spending a ton of time on these very, very, very niche pieces of history. And I just thought, well, I don't really know that that sounds as exciting to me as what I was envisioning. And I really want to try to find a way to make an impact on the present. Is this the way to do that? I'm not sure. So I ended up actually looking into the international policy space. You know, how can I apply what I've learned from my history degree to trying to make an impact on what's happening now? And I ended up at North Carolina State University in their international policy program. And one of my first professors was a man named Dr. Robert Reardon, who is an expert in nonproliferation, arms control. And I took his class, and that was it for me. Because I had done some Cold War history in undergrad and always been really fascinated by it. And so then, you know, I kind of caught the bug, as they say, like once I took the non-pro class and thought, man, like this is a really great opportunity to work on, at the time, what I viewed as being sort of like the most the biggest threat to humanity and our planet, which is nuclear weapons. And so that's what I set out to do. And my first job after graduate school was here in Washington, D.C. at the Stimson Center. And I did go there to work on nonproliferation, arms control, nuclear security. But what I ended up actually doing was much more in the nuclear security space. Mm-hmm. And sort of looking at how to incentivize the civil nuclear sector, nuclear power, to go above and beyond sort of existing security standards and regulations. And so through that work, I got to meet a ton of wonderful people in the nuclear power industry in many different countries, in the UK, in Canada, in the UAE, as they were standing up Baraka power plant and dealing with a number of really interesting security culture issues there. And that's sort of when I really learned about the applications of nuclear power for addressing climate change. And I decided kind of during that time, what I really wanted to do was find a way to work at the nexus of what I then determined to be the two gravest threats to humanity. And that was nuclear weapons and climate change. And, you know, peaceful uses of nuclear kind of sits at this bizarre sort of nexus of these two challenges, right? And ultimately what nuclear technology has done is reveal the best and worst instincts of humanity. We certainly know the damage that we can do with that technology. And we also see the peaceful uses and the applications for anything from carbon-free power to medical uses and agriculture that have been life-changing. And so I wanted to find a way to be able to use my skill set and my background to tackle that nexus. And Third Way, a center-left think tank here in DC, presented the opportunity for me. I met Josh Fried, the vice president of their climate program, through a colleague of mine, Susie Baker, at the time, who was there. They knew the work I had been doing in security and nonproliferation, and they needed somebody to come over and manage their nuclear work that had that background, especially when it came to the deployment of advanced reactors. There were lots of questions around what are the nonproliferation and security concerns for these new designs. And so that was my end. That was my opportunity to make this shift from, you know, sort of solely focusing on nuclear security to focusing on nuclear security and non-pro to solely focusing on, or really opening up and focusing on the nexus of that with climate. And so I spent a number of years at Third Way, which was an unbelievable learning experience. I mean, I had access to, you know, build my network and educate myself on not only our existing nuclear power plants and how they work and the applications for, well, really just how they operate as our clean energy foundation in this country. But then, of course, meeting pretty much everybody who's developing advanced nuclear and learning about all those designs. And so that work ultimately led me to leave Third Way and go to Oklo, a microreactor company based in California, to be their first ever director of government affairs. I really found that I wanted to help more directly contribute to building something, to actually building a facility that's going to physically contribute to reducing our carbon emissions. And that was a really exciting opportunity for me to go and work with folks that I knew well, and was really excited to just contribute to that team. And so I did, and had a wonderful experience there. I never in a million years thought I would work on fusion. Not because I, you know, didn't want to or didn't believe it was real necessarily, but I had been in the fission space for a really long time. I was very comfortable there. And it just seemed like a kind of a leap that wasn't necessary for me, I guess, career-wise. But last spring, Helion Energy reached out to me. They were looking to hire their first ever public affairs director to kind of form their department. And I was very skeptical, but our mutual friend Amy Roma said, you should really check them out, actually. I think you would be impressed. And so I first met with Sachin Desai, also a former Hogan Lovells alumni, and had coffee and learned more about the company, and was really impressed with how much progress was being made, the unique approach that Helion is taking to the deployment of fusion. And really what got me was, this is not a technology that I'm going to have to wait 30 years to see deployed. This company is ready to do this decade. They have a power purchase agreement with Microsoft. I went out and toured and saw with my own eyes that they're building their seventh prototype. They've been able to build machines and iterate. And so I got really excited to kind of stretch and move in a different way and contribute to another technology that I think is going to be incredibly important to the challenge of addressing climate change. And so that is a hopefully somewhat short, abbreviated explanation of how I got to where I am. I do still work some on the nuclear power side, just because I'm a non-resident senior fellow at Atlantic Council. And so I'm with their Global Energy Center and still contribute, particularly on issues around the nuclear fuel cycle and how we can address the challenges that we are still facing there.
Right. Wow, this is so impressive. I don't even think I knew some of that and those origin stories. But while I love the idea of you being this female Indiana Jones, you're now so uniquely positioned, having worked in both the advanced reactor space, now fusion. Are there specific projects or achievements in your career thus far that you're particularly proud of that you want to highlight?
Yeah, I think so. While I was at Third Way, there was definitely, when I first started working on advanced nuclear, there was still a lot of skepticism and concern about nonproliferation, potential nonproliferation threats and security threats with advanced nuclear technologies. And while I think there's some of that that still remains, we've seen a major shift in not just from the nonproliferation and security community, but really just, you know, both sides of the aisle politically. We've seen support grow on the Democrat side and Republican side for not only keeping our existing plants online, but deployment of these new advanced reactors. And I feel that I really was able to contribute to that in a meaningful way. I, you know, through work with colleagues of mine, mentors, really, Laura Holgate, Ambassador Laura Holgate to IAEA being one of them, she was absolutely critical to the work that we did to bring together stakeholders in the NNSA, our national lab community, and the academic nonproliferation community with these companies, these advanced nuclear companies for the first time, to sort of remove the stigma, I think, that existed at the time. This idea that, you know, if you were in an advanced nuclear company trying to deploy something new, that the non-pro and security community simply wanted to stand in your way, which wasn't always the case, right? And then on the other side, I think that a lot of folks in that non-pro community, whether it was in government or civil society, had sort of a similar assumption about the advanced nuclear community, that they didn't care enough about the security and non-proliferation issues. And they weren't, you know, sort of thinking about this in the design phase, which was also not entirely true. And so I think there was some really fantastic work that I accomplished at Third Way to, for the first time, bring those communities together in a productive way, to break down some of those silos, overcome some of those assumptions, and really move the ball forward with working together.
Yeah, we see that as well. And just building on those major shifts in the perspective of nuclear from both sides of the aisle that you're not only part to thank for, but also seeing every day. You know, we watch the news, we see how energy policy generally is front and center of conversations on Capitol Hill. What is your take on how any impending geopolitical shifts, political shifts in the U.S. will influence energy markets and trade in the coming years?
Wow, that is a big question. We could have a whole podcast on that. You know, I can say that just in the past number of, I mean, I guess like what, 2 to 3 years, we've seen in real time the impacts of geopolitical shifts on our energy dependence, not only here in the U.S., but with certainly with our allies in Europe and sort of around the world. I can say that to nuclear power specifically, you know, we face a challenge where, to be quite frank, the U.S. made a decision at some point to abdicate our leadership across the full nuclear supply chain. And wow, ended up in a situation where we're dependent on Russia for a, you know, significant amount of our nuclear fuel. And that's just traditional light water reactor fuel, let alone the high assay, low enriched uranium that many of these advanced nuclear power plants need. We don't have capacity in the U.S. to enrich to that at this point. We do now, actually, a tiny bit. A company called Centrus is actually doing a little bit of that. But we got ourselves into a bit of a pickle when it comes to the supply chain for our nuclear power plants, and we've seen that become even more amplified with the current situation with Russia and Ukraine. And so when we look at how Congress responds to that, we are seeing maybe a light at the end of the tunnel here on potential legislation moving this year that would fund an actual nuclear fuel program here in the U.S. through the Department of Energy to make sure that we do re-onshore or reshore, however we say that, that capacity here in the U.S. So I'm holding out as an eternal optimist that we will see that through, because I do think that that's absolutely necessary. Right. If we plan on as a country here domestically deploying new nuclear or keeping our nuclear plants online, it's critical that we have that domestic supply. And certainly if we want to sort of continue to see the expansion of nuclear across Europe and with our allies, we need to be able to be a supplier for them and sort of remove that dependency on Russia as well. So I think that's one example. And then I'll just kind of flip to fusion here for a second. I mean, the fuel cycle is completely different for fusion, right? There's no special nuclear material, whereas you're using uranium with nuclear power. With fusion, you're using, well, at least for our reactor, we're using deuterium and helium-3. Completely different profile. There's, you know, but the shift here, right, is, you know, nuclear power exists. It's been operating for many decades. Even when it comes to some of these advanced reactors, they've been demonstrated before in some cases. You know, we've seen fast reactors operate in a test capacity at a national lab for many years. With fusion, we're still waiting for that moment, that magic moment when we sort of move from concept to practical application. And I think that we're very close to that. And I think when it comes to geopolitical considerations, we have to really, as a country, as a government, and as an industry, make that transition mentally, that this is not the perpetual 30 years away technology that we've always sort of thought of it as. This is coming potentially in the next 5 years, at least demonstration. And we have to be ready to do what it takes to lead in that global marketplace. Yep. And, you know, we're not the only country pursuing this. Some of our biggest competitors are pursuing this, including China. And I think that they've successfully used a playbook in the past. We've seen it. We know it well, of having the U.S. invent a technology. I'll use solar as an example. And then sort of strategically taking over that supply chain and essentially the global marketplace for that technology that was actually invented here. And I really want to see us avoid falling into that same trap with fusion. And it's a tough situation, right? Like we haven't demonstrated yet. We think we will in the next few years. So I think there's a lot of good work that we can do now to actually be proactive in a policy landscape to build out what is the right policy framework. How can we build a runway through policy so that once we do demonstrate electricity production with a fusion machine, a commercial plant is feasible, make sure we have policies ready to go so that we can move quickly to ensure that we actually, as a country, gain leadership in that space instead of handing it away. And I think that's going to be really important.
Yeah. So you've mentioned Europe, you mentioned China, other international players, and some of the policy challenges associated with, you know, the global landscape. But as energy markets are also increasingly interconnected globally, are there opportunities that you foresee? Are there potential partnerships that maybe could unfold?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's beyond just deploying or exporting actual power plants or generation technologies from the U.S. I keep kind of coming back to that supply chain piece, right? I mean, this is absolutely critical. And so for us, at least in the fusion space, we're certainly looking at partnering with our allies. So Special Envoy Kerry made an announcement at COP. It's sort of a new national strategy at looking how we collaborate with our international partners on fusion specifically. That's certainly focused on R&D that still remains for some designs, but mentions of supply chain were a big part of that as well. Yeah. So I think that's going to be really key for us. Certainly looking at partnering with the UK, Japan, and a number of other allies. And then another way, and this is kind of like, I guess, a slight pivot from your question, but I think it's still in the realm of the conversation. There's a lot of work to be done in the sort of emerging market space. So you have this tension, right, where there are these countries that are just starting to grow their economies, just starting to grow their industrial base at a time when the world is telling them, okay, great, but you can't do it using the same energy technologies that we use. You can't use the oil, you can't use the gas or the coal. And, you know, it's really hard to build, to grow your economy, to build an industrial economy without firm baseload energy, and especially with high heat, right? For some of the manufacturing processes that are key to those economies, whether it's steel or cement or you name it. And so I think that for us as a country in the U.S., we need to really focus on, sure, making sure that we're helping with access for these countries to have solar and wind, you know, to power homes and things like that. But when we talk about energy poverty, which is a phrase we hear often, what we're really talking about is growing the economy, not just making sure that the average person in a country has access to electricity to light their home. Unbelievably important. But when we talk about growing economies, emerging from energy poverty, it's that baseload power that's going to be key. And so I do think the U.S. has an opportunity to play a bigger role, whether it's using our existing finance mechanisms through Ex-Im Bank and the U.S. Development Finance Corporation and a number of other sort of agencies to really focus on finding ways to make sure that U.S. developed, you know, clean, firm power is accessible to these emerging markets.
Yeah, these topics that you're mentioning, like decarbonization, resolving energy poverty, are hugely important. And I love hearing you even mention emerging markets, countries just now starting to grow these industries. So talking technology, and this maybe could be creative or as forward-thinking as you're willing to say, you know, what types of devices or tech do you think will play a crucial role in the future of our energy sector? And specifically, are there any significant innovations relative to fusion that are in the works that may shape, you know, Helion?
Yeah. So I'll talk on the tech side, and then I'll talk about innovations in regulation that I think will be game changing. So in the fusion side, for those that know anything about fusion or know a little bit about fusion, most people I think are aware of this mega project that's been under construction for what feels like a millennia in France. ITER, however you want to phrase it, this big international effort. It's gigantic. It's the size of a small town. If you actually go out there and visit it. So when you think about something that is going to be replicable, mass manufacturable, and like deployable, it's hard to envision that system really sort of being a game changer in how we change the world and how we use energy. There are companies here in the US that are trying to essentially take that same model, that tokamak design that most people have been working on. That's been the sort of predominant design in fusion. And what that design essentially does is pursue a steady state, sustained reaction, a sustained fusion reaction, right? So fission, we're splitting atoms. Fusion, we're fusing them together. And the tokamak design is trying to essentially recreate the process of our sun and any star in the universe. Once you basically kick off that reaction, it's sustaining itself. There's a lot of really complex physics problems that accompany that. And a number of other things that sort of require additional sort of protection for heat and radiation for that process. Helion is pursuing something very different. It's what's called a pulsed approach to fusion. So instead of trying to create that steady state, sustained reaction, our company said, well, can we just do fusion really fast in small increments over and over and over again? And does that help circumvent some of these issues and challenges? And the answer was yes. So Helion was founded about 10 years ago. The concept of a pulsed approach has actually been around since the same time the tokamak approach really came into view in the 40s or 50s. The issue at the time was that the power electronic technology had not advanced to a point where you could really pursue taking this from theory to for sort of practical application. What we've seen in the past 15 to 20 years is a rapid advancement in power electronics that has now allowed Helion to start building machines and iterating and trying this out. And so where we are now as a company is we are building our seventh prototype right now. And so I think what's allowed the company to move very quickly over 10 years is the regulatory framework that allows a fusion company, because there is no special nuclear material, to build and iterate and build and iterate. Whereas on the advanced nuclear side, the regulatory framework is much more stringent. And so you can't just go build these things and iterate and build again. I'll be completely frank with you. When I first went to Helion, I was actually really frustrated because it just kind of blew my mind that this company had been able to just build these fusion machines and operate them over and over again. Whereas I come from the advanced nuclear space and, you know, we have to wait years and years and years to get a license to build a test reactor, right? So it's just a totally different dynamic. But we're on track to complete our seventh prototype this year in 2024. And we are also on track to deliver a commercial power plant that's going to deliver 50 megawatts to Microsoft Energy by 2029. A lot of people raise eyebrows at that. I think it's a really hard mental shift for folks when they think about fusion to think about that as being near term. But I can say confidently that we're really in a good place to deliver on that. The other challenge the innovation area I'll mention is regulatory, not just sort of NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulations, but energy regulation. Power markets, how these are structured. What we're seeing is projections for an increase in energy demand that is mind-blowing over the next 15 to 20 years due to a number of reasons. Certainly tech like AI and other things are going to really like ratchet that up, but also just in the US alone, the increase of manufacturing in this country. And so when you look at this and you look at the capacity of our grid to provide that, you sort of reach a point pretty quickly where you say, we're going to have to start moving some of these loads off the grid and behind the meter. And there's a lot of work to be done through regulation and sort of modernizing our energy markets to allow for that to happen. In this country, we have deregulated markets and regulated markets. And the regulated markets, the utilities are king. They have the monopoly. And so it's difficult, if not impossible right now, for a company like Helion to go in and, say, move a steel facility off the grid behind the meter and just provide power to them. So what we're working on now, and I think this is certainly applicable beyond the fusion space. There's lots of different technologies that can do this, but there's a lot of work and innovative thought to be done on how we actually reform our energy markets, modernize our energy regulations so that these innovative technologies can actually provide the power either behind the meter or on the grid in the way that's going to help us actually achieve these goals. And so I think there's opportunities to see over the next few years, hopefully by 2030, we can see some excellent work from the NGO space, policymakers, industry, all sort of putting their heads together to fruition.
Yeah, you're at the epicenter of engaging like these stakeholders, the regulators, to actually determine if there's a pathway for generating electricity, working with utilities, and providing power behind the meter. Like it's fascinating. You and your work are significant and just generally inspiring. I don't have any other questions, but like I could talk to you for hours about this stuff. So I appreciate you giving us 20 minutes ish.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it. And I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's all about finding something you're passionate about and finding ways throughout your career to carve out new paths for yourself to keep learning new things, right?
Yeah.
I think in any career, you can find yourself sort of in a rut, right? Like you've gotten too comfortable. Things seem monotonous. Things seem, you know, kind of you could do it in your sleep. And so I think it's important to find new ways to stretch and think about things and have new challenges. And so I've been really lucky to sort of have doors open and have the courage to walk through them when they do to do that. And I also think that mentors are really important. If we're thinking about, you know, women that have been inspiring in the energy space, the list is very long and growing, thankfully. But I can say, you know, I mentioned Laura Holgate earlier. You know, I met her like very soon after I got to DC, and she, of course, was very senior to me, but immediately took the time to get to know me and sort of take me under her wing like she had done for many, many other women. And she's just one example of the women in my life that have done that for me in Washington, DC, especially. And so I think when we think about women, not only in energy, but in, you know, various sectors across the world that are continuing to sort of climb that ladder and do new things. I take a lot of time to try to do the same thing that she did for me, for other women, that are younger and interested and passionate and wanting to, chart their own path through energy in their own way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm grateful to know you and to have gotten to speak with you today. And thank you so much, Jackie.
Thanks, Stephanie. This has been fun.